This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for July 15th, 2014. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. I'm Drew Messenger Michaels. Thanks so much for being here. You know, I used to apologize every single time an episode had bad audio, particularly on the interviewee's side. I don't really do that so much anymore. I've sort of embraced the idea that this is going to be a variable fidelity podcast. You know, if my interview subject doesn't have access to a really good microphone, I'll do the best I can to clean it up. But, you know, the important thing is getting to talk to these people. The audio wizardry kind of comes second. Last week's interview with Lila Newman, which is, I think, a really good conversation, and do check it out if you haven't yet, doesn't have the best audio, right? It's over Skype, and you know, her microphone's not fantastic, and etc., right? But it's audible, it works. This week we have really good audio, because it just so happens I am interviewing Jeff Blair and Matt Hackett, who are the guys behind The Lost Cast, and also the guys behind Lost Decade Games, and they've just put out their first game, A Wizard's Lizard. Hey, I said it right. I say it wrong a lot. Anyway, they have really nice microphones ready at hand because they are, after all, podcasters. So this week, you get a break from suffering through strange audio. Anyway, A Wizard's Lizard is a game somewhat in the vein of The Binding of Isaac. It appears at first glance to be pretty much precisely like The Binding of Isaac, but it's different in some interesting ways, and similar for reasons that may be different than the ones you expect. You might be expecting it to be sort of derivative or a ripoff, but it's a bit more interesting than that. So I'll let the Lost Decade guys talk about that element. But the basic setup is you are the familiar of a wizard. You're the familiar of a wizard, I should say. You are his cute little lizard. Anyway, your master has been kidnapped by death itself, and it's up to you to bring him back, and that takes the form of you fighting with projectiles through procedurally generated, cemeteries and sewers and other, video gamey spaces. I like it a lot. I think it's worth checking out if you are into that kind of game, and what I mean by that kind of game and why they're interesting and all that is something that the interview concerns as well. Spoiler alert, it all kind of traces back to Spelunky for a lot of people. I should mention, the audio you're about to hear picks up after Jeff and I have been talking for a minute or so off mic while Matt went to get his good microphone. So you didn't miss much, you really just missed me asking whether the plan was originally to be podcasters or game developers, and perhaps unsurprisingly, the answer was, game development comes first for them. The podcast is a way of keeping a community together and keeping themselves sane and all of that. But look, enough with the notes already. You don't care. You don't care about audio quality. You want it to be good, right? But you're here for the interview. So here it is. Jeff Blair, Matt Hackett, Lost Decade Games, A Lizard's Wizard. Shit, A Wizard. Here's the interview. Let me first of all make sure I don't mispronounce your names when I introduce you guys. So it's just Jeff Blair, right? It's not Joff or anything.
Yeah, it's just Jeff.
That is what I thought.
He gets that a lot. Geoff is a common one.
Geoff is good.
I've been getting that my entire life, so I'm used to it.
Excellent. No, that's fine. I got a ridiculous name myself, so I completely understand. Drew is pretty straightforward, but my folks gave me every family name. I am Drew Ethan Messenger Michaels Holtzman. So it doesn't fit on any forms. I've never
it's
filled
a lot
out
of names.
It's all the names. It should end with a the third or Esquire or or something. Yes. And the guy I do the podcast with, who is not here at the moment, is Lucio Alfredo Santiago Valentino, which is just as long, but a lot kind of sexier.
Is that just
sexier.
A coincidence that you two have these huge, enormous names?
Yeah, that is a complete coincidence. It's not like we didn't get them like matching tattoos when we started doing stuff together. The world's most verbose tramp stamps. That's what that would be. Okay, so.
Nice.
So what Matt and I were talking about while we were waiting for audio to get worked out was just, I kind of asked whether the original plan was to make games or to make podcasts, since you guys do both. Well, let's do this. Let's do the newlywed game. So I got Matt's answer on that. Jeff, what would you say?
So I would say the original plan was always to make games. What ended up happening is that we were working at a company, actually making games, and we were kind of getting burnt out with the company in general, and so we kind of wanted to start something on the side. And Matt had always been interested in podcasting, and then he kind of finally convinced me to get on board with it.
It's kind of easy when you don't like your job that much, because Jeff will be sitting there working, hating his life, and I'm like, hey, you want to go podcast for an hour? And he's like, it's an easy sell. He's like, I'd rather do almost anything for an hour, so yes. And part of it came from the fact that I went to school for, I guess, audio engineering. It was actually television production, but there was a lot of overlap and a lot of like new media and internet stuff. But I came out of it with a pretty strong knowledge of audio engineering and some of the hardware that was required. So I kind of already had the prerequisites for how to do it. So we were like, let's just do it. And we also followed Wolffire Games pretty closely, and they've been hugely successful, obviously, and they're big proponents of open development and just, you know, establishing a relationship with your gamers audience. Like, it made a lot of sense for us to just be open and just try it out, because nobody else was really doing it in the indie developer scene.
It's interesting that so when I realized, like I was saying to Matt, I came to your podcast through your game, right? And it's maybe some people come the other way. But it was interesting to me that the game you chose to make, as guys who are interested in open development and who are podcasting and all that, was a game like A Wizard's Lizard, which is kind of a Binding of Isaac-esque, you know, secret pact, really deep systems kind of a game, which doesn't lend itself to what you might think of as open development, early access and people giving feedback on betas and stuff. It's kind of more like a mysterious object that should just appear, at least, in some people's view. So is there kind of a tension there, or am I way, way overthinking this?
I don't think you're way overthinking it, but we're actually pretty good about doing open development. We've tried to foster a pretty tight-knit community of people that are interested in the game and do beta testing and stuff for us, and we run kind of limited betas in the public through our forum, and then also recently, and that we've been on Steam, we've been doing development updates and pushing beta branches to any user that wants to try them out. But you're right, it is kind of a very secret-filled game, so we don't give everything away. Sometimes we kind of leave things for launch. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting dynamic.
I would say that A Wizard's Lizard is actually an excellent game choice for an early access style game, because having that roguelike design, you can go almost any which direction. And we've seen a lot of feedback from players, a lot of suggestions from players. If you were making a game, say like Portal or Braid, that would be, I think, not the best choice for early access, because it's more of a finite design, you know? There's less, hey, what would be cool in this area? Or what might be something neat we could try? And more just, it's this narrowly defined kind of beautiful thing that just gets created and is done. You know, there's less feedback and iteration involved, at least with the fans.
That makes sense. And hypothetically, less replaying, right? Like, I love Portal. I mentioned I had a thesis on video games. My thesis was on Portal, right? So, like, I've played Portal, you know, dozens of times, but most people play it once through, maybe twice, and that's that. Yeah. Whereas something that's more, you know, more roguelike, like, is always going to be intrinsically replayable. I hope, by the way, I'm not offending you by comparing the game to Binding of Isaac pretty explicitly.
Oh, well, we get it a lot.
Yeah.
we're hard to offend, and the comparisons, I think, are obvious, and they happen all the time. It's actually interesting, because it was never our intention to make a game like that. If you go back to 2010 and you look at the very first game we ever launched, it's called Onslaught Arena. And it was a kind of a dual stick action game. It looks, feels, and plays a lot like A Wizard's Lizard. And the way that we approached A Wizard's Lizard was more from, let's take Onslaught Arena and expand it, right? And less, hey, Binding of Isaac is a, you know, hit game, let's follow that. That was never our intention, but we, for better or for worse, we did end up in a place where we made a game a lot like it.
Yeah, well, and either way, it's not so much that there's accusations of plagiarism or whatever to be had. It's more just like, it's interesting to think about how much the two games share DNA. and kind of come from the same places, and also how much a Wizard's Lizard kind of to me, by you know, the Binding of Isaac is very much 8-bit in some ways, right? Like not visually, but it's, you know, you only have the four cardinal directions, and it's very much Zelda 1, and a Wizard's Lizard kind of takes that in the directions that 16 and 32-bit games did, where you have more directions to play with. Like I always play Binding of Isaac with keyboard, and I would always play a Wizard's Lizard with two sticks with a controller, because it's just, it moves and feels differently and is a little bit more, I mean, there's dialogue and there's you know, a hub town and all these things that happened later in game development. So it is almost an answer to the question, like, what if we took this current, you know, generation of roguelike alikes or whatever the shit we're calling them, and took it to the, you know, developed it along the same lines that games as a whole developed, you know, back in the day.
I think, Binding of Isaac is more like Zelda 1 influence, and we're more Zelda 3 influence. And also a big influence on us was Spelunky. A lot of the stuff we designed in the game was kind of along those lines.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons it's so similar, is because we had inspirations in exactly the same places. And that could be seen as, you know, bad on us because we didn't see that someone else had already kind of, you know, walked that path. And so we didn't realize we were following in those footsteps.
Yeah, well, it is really interesting. I mean, because again, it doesn't play like a ripoff, because we're used to playing ripoffs. We play, you know, if you've played a Vlambeer game, you're aware that, you know, that that their games get ripped off and those ripoffs exist, right?
Right.
The whole Threes controversy recently and stuff like that. A Wizard's Lizard doesn't feel like that. It feels like an alternate path, the same way that, you know, like there was Portal and then there was Portal 2, but there was also Quantum Conundrum, and it represented not so much a ripoff of either as an alternate way that that philosophy of game development could branch.
Well, that's good to hear. I definitely don't like hearing that it looks and feels like a clone. I understand it from a lot of places. One of them is that the art style. I read Edmund McMillan's postmortem on Binding of Isaac, and so his art style was kind of simple by necessity, and plus they were using Flash, which does vectors easily, and it just made a lot of sense. And the reason that we do a similar-ish art style is just because it's like cheap to produce, you know, like I can rapidly output graphics, but it just so happens that it's in a style that looks a lot like a game that's very similar to.
Yeah, but it is not in fact Flash, if I'm not mistaken.
No, we actually made it in HTML5.
Yeah, HTML5 is actually another reason, getting back to the podcast, that we started podcasting, is that when we started doing game development, it was in HTML5, and that was when it was just becoming a thing, and there wasn't a whole lot of information about HTML5 games and how to make them and what to do with them out there, and so we kind of started doing the podcast to get involved in the community there.
That makes sense. And it's you know, again, it's an evolutionary path that needs to happen, because so much great stuff has been, Binding of Isaac included, has been hampered or outright lost by being kind of stuck in the world of Flash. I was a big player of Glitch when it was around, and it, you know, it's gone forever because, you know, Flash kind of kept it from people playing it on their iPads, and that was that. I don't know if I don't mean to drop an obscure reference. It was this like Flash-based MMO that was made by a studio founded by the guy who founded, I want to say, Flickr.
Right. Yeah.
And the Katamari guy was involved, and it was just this weird, non-combative, you know, hyper surreal MMO thing that existed for a while, and it was great, and it died, and it was sad.
I thought they opened up all that. I don't know if they open sourced the code exactly, but I'm pretty sure they at least, I don't know if it was public domain or Creative Commons or what, but I thought they gave away at least all the assets.
They did do that with all the assets, yeah. So far, no one has stepped up to the plate to like host the world, which I imagine would be a pretty, you know, tremendous undertaking.
Yeah, definitely could be.
Yeah,
I think that Binding of Isaac and also Realm of the Mad God, which is also created in Flash, are really good examples of how tech doesn't matter as much as people think it does within the realm of game development. I mean, Binding of Isaac is on like Flash 2, which is like a really old and terrible platform.
Just the side of stone tablets. Yeah.
Right, basically, right? And it's like hugely popular. Realm of the Mad God's also very popular, also done in Flash. It's just, you know, further proof that even old busted technology, you know, can be used to make popular games.
And that's been interesting to see, because we started, like Jeff was saying, it was a very techie podcast. We talk a lot about, how do you do this in HTML5? Is this even possible? And then as the podcast has matured over the years, it's now more like, okay, so we have the tech figured out. We have this game that's marketable. Now it's all about, how do you form a business around a game? How do you pay rents with your game? That kind of stuff.
Well, it's almost like, you know, with any new or old technology, it's that that media theorist Clay Shirky talks about how you can't use technology in interesting ways until that particular technology becomes at least a little bit boring, right? Like if it's completely shiny and new, then all it's going to be, we see this every year with E3, where whatever latest graphics tech is out there and shiny and attractive is being used to make some of the most boring looking stuff possible, right? Boring looking in the sense of art design, but also just in the sense of, really, that's what we're doing. In my opinion, it seems to me, not to lob a bomb.
Yeah, that's interesting. Nice.
So what have you guys been playing? That's a really generic, silly question, but it usually yields interesting results. Or have you had time to play anything, getting the game launched?
Actually, I've been trying to relax as much as possible. It's been really hard. We talked about that a little bit on our podcast about how difficult it is to relax right now. And we both really want to, but it's hard to find a way to make ourselves. But I've actually been playing a few different indie games recently. In the not so distant past, I was playing Risk of Rain, which is kind of another indie roguelike, however you want to call it.
We need a better word. We all desperately need a better word. Yeah, Risk of Rain is incredible.
Yeah, Risk of Rain is a lot of fun. Really, really hard, which I really like. And more recently, I was playing a little bit of Delver, which is out of a studio that I met at Good Game Club, which is a kind of an indie gathering show-off that we attended. I think it was earlier this year. But yeah, it's kind of like a first-person dungeon crawler. It's almost got like a Minecraft vibe to it, but it's more of a dungeon crawler and less of an open world sandbox.
I've been playing a fair bit of Eldritch, which is similar. It's got kind of a Minecraft-ish blocky feel to it, but it's kind of it is a roguelike to light-alike, and it's it's got that same look about it, but it's kind of deep systems that aren't explained and all that kind of stuff. It's fun.
There's a new term going around called procedural death labyrinth that I kind of like, although I don't. It might be too too many words to actually stick, but it's a pretty good, different explanation for rogue like light. Whatever you want to say there.
Yeah. PDL, I think.
It's like PDL. FPS. Yeah.
PDL. Yeah.
Public display of roguelike alike. Well, terminology is interesting, right? Because you could make the argument that games don't actually have probably the genres they're going to end up having, right? Like we have platformer and first-person shooter, but those are not genres that work the way genres do in any other medium. They don't tell you stuff about like tone or intent or what's going to happen. They just tell you about perspective, technology, So I don't know. Is Spec Ops: The Line really the same genre as Gears of War, right? Like, does that make sense to say?
Right, yeah.
And so many games are a mismatch of many different genres, and the way that they're put together is different. If you have two, it's a puzzle platformer, but some puzzle platformers are more platformer and less puzzle, and some are more puzzle and less platform. So even among the spectrum, you don't know where any given game falls. There was a thread on our Steam forum recently for Wizards Lizard, where people were complaining about the genres that we chose for the game. So we chose indie, action, and RPG because to us, Legend of Zelda, which is a huge influence, is kind of a classic example of an action RPG. And we felt that Wizards Lizard kind of felt that fit in that category as well. But a lot of people were kind of being pedantic about whether or not it's an RPG and what that exactly means and stuff like that. But it really exposed to me how limited Steam's genre classifications actually are.
Well, that's why they introduced the tag system, which is utter chaos, but at least an attempt, I guess.
It's better than nothing, yeah.
Yeah, but Steam by default gives you about a dozen categories to pick from, which, doesn't do a whole lot for actually categorizing your game.
No, definitely not. Well, and the thing is, I've never in my life shopped by, show me an action RPG with roguelike elements. I'm sure there are people who do that, but I've never done it. And even though I'm very, very interested in that combination of things, it would never occur to me to do like a faceted search in Steam for those three things.
Yeah, I can't think of one time I've ever like browsed by genre, maybe just on a whim or something, but they never drive to purchases, that's for sure. It seems to be this very secondary or tertiary thing.
And that really kind of speaks to the power of Steam's homepage as a promotional tool right now.
Yeah.
They are a bunch of these kind of subpages. I remember when the Steam Summer Sale launched, Matt saw some person link, it was like a list of like PDL games, right? And a Wizards Lizard was on that page. And there's all kinds of these like sub pages that aggregate games by category on Steam. And we were featured on a few of them. for a little while, and we still are. And like, you don't really see that much traffic from those particular pages because, like you were saying, you know, hardly anyone actually visits those hubs.
Yeah. I'm actually, and I, maybe, the, oh, there they are. Okay. I wasn't finding the tags on the Wizard's Lizard page, right now, but there it is. So yeah. So user defined tags, and this is very useful stuff. Are RPG, indie, action, roguelike, and roguelite. So in other words, pretty much the exact same stuff that you were putting on there, plus the confusing, you know, PDL sorts of terms, and that's it, right? So
yeah.
The tagging system in this case is not solving much, probably.
No, not really, but it gives some people something to do, I guess.
Definitely. Well, and it lets people label Team Fortress 2 a hat simulator, so that's the really important thing. So, okay, so as far as the PDL thing, I did want to ask you guys, I am really, really into that genre, whatever we wish to call it, or that philosophy, right? The idea of replayability and randomness and death and challenge and overcoming it and all that. I was not that interested in the roguelikes that people who use the term roguelike get serious about calling roguelikes, right? I wasn't into Rogue back in the day. I didn't really play like Sheeran the Wanderer or the ones that were out on Wii. I got into it, you know, when Spelunky came along and when Binding of Isaac came along and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So were you guys similar, or were you into that kind of hardcore stuff back in time immemorial?
Spelunky.
Yeah.
it's we talk about Spelunky all the time in our podcast. It really had a very deep impact on both of us, and we were both really into it at the same time. I just want to point out that I got far more achievements than Jeff. So he got completely owned. I got them all on Xbox, the Spelunky on Xbox, and I put like 80 hours into it or something ridiculous. I was really into it. It just hit this perfect combination of, you know, classic gameplay, but some new, really interesting design choices that changed everything, you know?
I think that both Matt and I kind of come from a place of playing old school RPGs and action games.
Yeah.
Specifically platformers and like action RPGs like Legend of Zelda. We both have a very strong common history of playing that game. Shining Force,
oh, yeah.
Final Fantasy, those kinds of games. And so I think that for us, it was more about these rogue-like PDL kind of elements fused with the action RPG kind of games that we loved was a better fit. Because, you know, I'm in the same boat. I played Rogue, but I was never into it. And, you know, for me, the kind of combat that is very typical of a actual roguelike, which is, you know, you kind of bump into enemies to attack them. I never really enjoyed that all that much. And so that's kind of why, you know, a game like a Wizard's Lizard is right up our alley, because we like fast-paced combat, dodging, jumping, moving, shooting, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think a big part, too, is that, you know, Jeff was talking about some of the classic Final Fantasy games and Shining Force, which is a turn-based strategy RPG. And those games, we loved them back when we had much more time, you know, and these days, like, it sucks. I don't have 8 hours I can spend playing a game, although I'd love to, you know. So we crave more like, you know, bursts of gameplay. I want to play for 30 minutes. I want to play for 60 minutes. And that's all that I've got. But I want to be able to make progress, and I want to be able to demonstrate skill. I don't always just want to, I mean, I'm not talking bad about RPGs because I love them, but I don't always just want to deal with menus and just select actions. Sometimes I want to be the one causing the action, you know?
Right, yeah. Well, the one thing about like an older school PDL that was appealing is the idea of having this character who is mortal around in your head across several gameplay sessions or whatever. But it is like, while I like that in theory, in practice, it's just heartbreaking when that character dies, and it's much more satisfying to do what... I mean, the other term I've heard is lunch break roguelike, right? Where you can just kind of, you know, you have a half hour, see what you can do. Because even a completely successful Spelunky run, which only a handful of people have experienced, doesn't take that long, right? Like it feels like an eternity because so much happens in it, but it's actually in linear Earth time, not that long.
I actually think that we hit a really good spot with the length of a Wizard's Lizard. I mean, we started off in various places, but where we ended up now is that if you do a kind of a complete run where you're like looking in every nook and cranny and finding every item and exploring every room, it's a little bit over an hour. So that's kind of like, you know, a lunch break or, you know, an hour is kind of a nice amount of time. And then it scales down even to like 20 minutes if you're trying to speedrun it.
And it's, and well, so, yeah, the true sign that it's balanced well is I now get through the first area really quick, right? Like, I have, to be full disclosure, haven't beaten it yet, but, you know, I'm in the sewers in the time it, I'm in the sewers in the time it used to take me just to get killed by a werewolf, you know, so it's, I'm definitely improving. I totally get
it. Yeah,
and
it's like kind of same thing with, I was gonna say, it's like the same thing with like a game like Spelunky, right? You know, I spent a long time, you know, just trying to get to the jungle.
Yeah.
I would get to the jungle and then I would die immediately. And then, you know, but eventually, you know, you get to the point where like, you know, 2.5 minutes in and you're in the jungle and easy.
Yeah, no, and that was the crazy, on like on a longer timeline. I also played on the Xbox quite a bit, and then when the game came out on PC, I grabbed it, and I had laboriously fought my way to the jungle, and then on through the ice caves and all that. And when I got it on PC and I had those skills, I like, you know, had gotten Tunnel Man everything he needed in like, you know, an hour and a half, which was different.
Yeah, very different experience.
Exact same experience.
Yeah, I remember that, getting like the first time you get to the temple, you immediately get smashed by one of those moving blocks.
right.
And like the same thing in the City of Gold. And that was pretty much true across the board. Every time I got to a new area, I was like, ooh, what's this? You're dead. And I like, for some reason, I don't know why, that either hits you in a really bad spot. I've seen some people react really negatively to that, you know, like, I just got there and you killed me. That's terrible, you know. But to me, it was just barely enough to keep me going. And that's something I'm really interested in these days, is what is it that drives a player to continue playing? And what is it that caused a player to, you know, put the gamepad down and not pick it up again? You know,
well, to me, you know, I'm conducting an informal survey of Spelunky players to see whether this was only a problem for me. But the one time I got frustrated enough to not play for a while was the first time I got to hell and got immediately killed. Because that's just, there's such an amount of work, and it's, you know, like, even a pretty good run, you can end up not there, and the fact that there's no shortcut ever, so that you can't just poke around, there's no, because part of the joy of Spelunky is the trial and error aspect, and just like, I wonder what this does, oh, I'm dead fun. And if getting there takes, again, not a huge amount of time, but a Herculean effort and a Dark Soulsian level of absolute concentration, it can be really frustrating to have that kind of taken away, so maybe I'm weak, but, yeah.
Yeah, I would love to know what it is exactly, and how to overcome that tipping point, you know, because that's the case a lot of times is, you know, you, for as an example, you showed that you can get to hell, you know, you are capable of doing it, and you have the desire to do it. And if the game lost you at some point, one way to think about that is the game let you down. The game failed you, you know, it failed to pull you to the end, because that's what the game desperately wants to do, you know. Yeah. When they design the game, in an ideal world, 100% of the players will love it to death and get all the way to the end, but that's obviously not going to happen. In fact, the numbers are just shockingly low, you know. It's like probably less than 1% of people who have bought or played Spelunky even will ever get to hell, you know. And pretty much the more content the players consume, the better it is for everyone.
Well, Spelunky is that Spelunky's philosophy? Because I don't know. Like, I don't think most people... I think it does revel to a certain degree in there being this other path, you know, hell, that most people will not see, right? Like, most people will beat Olmec, and that'll be a Herculean effort. In fact, even just saying most people will beat Olmec may not be a correct statement.
No.
But that's plenty of challenge for most people, is my point, right? So part of what I think people like about Spelunky is that you kind of have to pass around how stuff works, like an urban legend or wiki it or whatever, or just poke at it for a long time. And it doesn't particularly, I don't know, it's not that it doesn't want you to finish it, but it may not care whether you finish it.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, I kind of enjoy that, because I have personally never been to hell in Spelunky, because, you know, I'm reckless and crazy and I can't seem to concentrate. But I thoroughly enjoyed the game, you know, and the game had a lot to offer me, and, you know, some part of me wished I would beat it 100%, but another part of me is like, you know, I had a lot of fun with the game. I still go back and play it every so often, and I haven't seen, you know, this particular piece of content, and that's, you know, largely okay with me.
Here's what I mean about the, like, the creators want people to experience the content is, like, we feel like we've kind of made some design errors with the Wizard's Lizard, because most people who play it, they're not going to see the crypt, you know, they're not going to see the hidden zones, because it's really difficult and there are hidden secrets, and most people won't bother to, you know, either just play the game long enough till they figure it out, or go look it up on a forum or talk to a friend. When you can look at this drop off, you know, like, there's a certain percentage of people who've heard of it, and of that, there's a certain percentage of people who've bought it, and of that, there's a certain percentage of people who've played it, And of that, like, most of them probably played level one and then moved on with their lives, played a different game. And there's all these series of, like, very series of drop-offs, and we don't want any of it. You know, we want people to play all the game and see all the content. It's great, obviously, to see, you know, the, oh, here's some content that's kind of, you know, rare, or not everybody gets to see it, that kind of a thing. But I think in general, what creators want is they want people to enjoy all their content, or else why do you do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I like to talk about World of Warcraft a lot because I played it for a number of years, and they had a very kind of similar trajectory. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but basically when World of Warcraft came out, it was very much like EverQuest, in the sense that it was huge raids of people that were hard to coordinate, and the bosses were really hard, and it took like 7 to 10 hours to crawl the dungeons with like 40 people, and it was just this massive undertaking that was only available to the hardest of the hardcore. And it's especially interesting in a case like that where, you know, a company like Blizzard is spending hundreds of thousands of man hours and, you know, millions of dollars creating this end game content that's the hardest content for them to create in the game, because it needs to be expertly balanced and really challenging and fun and rewarding and all those things. And then, you know, what ended up happening is, like Matt was saying, there was like sub 1% of their player base was actually even attempting this content, let alone completing it. And so if you look at like the kind of trajectory of the raid game in World of Warcraft, they've consistently been making it more and more accessible to players. You know, they've been adding tiers so that people can experience the content, but at a slightly less difficult level with slightly less great rewards and things like that. But yeah, I think that, you know, it kind of speaks to the fact that a lot of people that are spending lots of time creating this content, like, they don't want it to just be consumed by, you know, the 1%.
Yeah, the 1%. Yeah, exactly. So are you guys Dark Souls players? Because I've been thinking about this a lot in the concept of Dark Souls 1 versus 2. I don't know if you guys care about that particular series.
I do. I love Dark Souls. Well, I mean, I do and I don't. Dark Souls is a tough game for me because on one hand, I really, really like it because it's really hard and it's got great atmosphere and it hits me in all the right spots, just from a game perspective. But the thing about it is that it is one of these games that I feel like I can't really play effectively without some kind of a guide, which I don't typically like to do. Mm. Because, again, it's like a time thing. You know, if I was 12 and I would love Dark Souls to death every which way, right? Because I would be spending, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day playing this game, and I would know all the secrets and all the nooks and crannies. But as it stands, you know, when I have like an hour to play and I'm constantly dying and having to rerun the same area in Dark Souls and I don't feel like I'm making progress without, you know, looking things up on the internet, it kind of diminishes the experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. So have you played the second one? Because they make all kinds of concessions to that, which I find pretty interesting.
I actually haven't played the second one yet. So, I've been meaning to, but...
So they introduced the concept of respecking, basically. There's, like, limited items that let you do that. So the main thing that could make time sinking really brutal in the first one is that you when you spend your points, you've spent your points, and that's that. And it won't actually stop you from screwing yourself pretty badly. They fixed is a controversial word, I guess, but they changed that. They made the co-op much more functional. They did all this stuff to, like, you know, to kind of answer the question, like, well, people like this series, but what if we wanted to make an entry that non-crazy people and adults might have time to play too, right? Yeah. And it's interesting because I think it's pretty successful as that. Yeah, it's worth your time for sure. The story's not as good as the first one, which is a weird thing to say because the story is only as there as you want it to be in the first one, but it's definitely an interesting thing from a design perspective.
I like that. And I'm sure that there's a bunch of complaining about that when it came out. And just like any game that makes itself more accessible is bound to draw criticism from the people that were previously, you know, the only people to complete the game. But I think that what ends up happening is that those people are still served anyway, in a lot of cases, and you're just doing yourself a service by making the game more accessible to other people.
Yeah, definitely. I did the worst podcast thing. I started talking about a thing that you guys don't know about that I do, which is not interesting. This isn't about me.
Jeff was really into it for a while, but yeah, it just kind of, I think, you know, caught up with him because it required lots of research and lots of practice. And you know, we're at this point where not only will we only have, like, say I've got just this 1 hour, but for me it's also like in that hour I don't really want to do any learning, which is why I've been drifting towards games where it's like, I want to play a jump and shoot game, you know, like a Mega Man type game where I don't have to know all this information about all these systems. There aren't like five different buttons. There aren't all these subtle gestures and stuff. It's run, jump, shoot, jump and shoot, jump and shoot. Like, there can still be lots of interesting challenges within just those mechanics, but I want to not have to learn a lot, you know?
I don't, yeah,
it's
totally.
It's really interesting you bring up Mega Man, because I just watched a video, Sequelitis, about Mega Man.
Yeah.
And he's just going on and on about how great Mega Man is, because they do a really great job of teaching you the game without getting in your way.
Right.
You know, they kind of organically show you the more complicated pieces of the game as you go, and they give you a chance to kind of understand what's going to happen, and then they throw things at you in combinations and stuff like that.
I was thinking about that video a lot when I played the first level of Shovel Knight, because it does all that stuff. Like, it just, in order to teach you how you use your shovel, it just presents you with these situations that, without explaining how you get through them, just, you know, to get through each one in a low pressure, not too many enemies coming at you way, you have to think of the different stuff you can do, like holding down to just crash through the ground, or digging up piles, or whatever. And it was great. It was a really, really good example of that, which you don't see too much. You know, we are very, you know, tooltip focused as a rule.
That sounds appropriate for a game that's, made to look like it belongs on a Nintendo, because around that era is when a lot of these design examples were given to us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the original Mario Brothers has that in spades, where just the game design itself will kind of, you know, suggest you can jump up there and you can avoid this, and it gives you everything. It kind of meters it out gently. And, it's interesting to see how the games industry got way away from that. And to touch on Sequelitis again, the more recent Zelda one talks about this a lot, where old-style good game design will, you know, present you with challenges and give you tools to solve them, and they're so well put together that you can just figure it out. And then modern games seem to be, all right, let's sit down, and I'm going to explain this to you, and here's a paragraph of text you've got to read to even have the tools available, and I'll describe the inputs to you, and here's a screen full of a gamepad pointing at every single button, describing the three different things that button does, and it's just information overload. It's exhausting, you know? And I don't know why modern game design has gone that way, but that seems to be where we are.
I somehow missed that there was a new Sequelitis, first of all, so noted. That's good news.
It's very new. It was like 2 days ago.
Sure enough. All right, well, I'll be watching that as soon as we're done here. In fact, guys, hang on. I'll watch it. No, but it's... So part of it, I think, is... I was talking to my co-podcaster about this in terms of Transistor recently, where Transistor is really, really bold in its assumption that you're like, literate in video game systems, that you understand what it means to work in real time and what it means to be turn-based, and that you can go back and forth between the two, and it doesn't hold your hand. Where I think something like Ocarina of Time, or especially the Zelda, Skyward Sword comes to mind, really treat you as though you've never played a video game before, in the interest of hypothetically being very accessible, I suppose. And maybe that's what it is. Maybe back in the day, the games had to teach. I think this is Ego Raptor's contention in Sequelitis. Games had to teach through their gameplay, because that was the tool they had. You couldn't dump a bunch of text in there just for the purpose of tutorializing.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting point, because these days... what is that thing that comes with Wii U? It's like this Nintendo area where you can walk around this little world with your little Mii avatar.
The Miiverse, right?
Miiverse, yeah. And you can pick these various places to go and play arcade games. And the entire time, you're hounded by this little robot who appears, "Hello, Mario, let me explain everything to you." It's so obnoxious. And, you know, they couldn't do that back in the 80s. You know, you could have a screen with some text, but you couldn't really have like a digitized voice and this character animated and using its hands to speak to you and stuff.
Oh, you mean Nintendo?
It almost feels like...
Yeah. You don't even mean the Miiverse. You mean Nintendo Land, right? The thing that the Wii Sports
Nintendo
Land came with it? Totally. Yeah.
That one. Yeah. Like, it was pretty cool. It came with that, and it comes with 8 kind of retro-inspired games. You know, like, here's a tiny little shooter with the Metroid, or in the Metroid universe, and, you know, here's a little game inspired by, Wrecking Crew or something. And that was great, but I was so turned off by just these constant menus and explaining everything, and I just wanted to play, you know?
We actually started down kind of a bad path with the tutorial in A Wizard's Lizard. Originally, when we were developing the game, we had this tutorial dungeon. There was a whole tutorial dungeon, and it was like each room was meant to teach you one thing, you know? So it'd be like, here's your sword, here's how you attack, you know, and it would tell you how you attack, and then... it would give you a room full of bats and you'd have to kill them. Then it would move on to the next room and it would teach you one more thing. And at the time, I thought that was pretty cool. And then I was showing it off to some like an indie dev meetup here in the Bay Area. And one of the guys that I was talking to, he was like, you know, can I suggest something? And I was, you know, sure, why not? And he's like, I suggest that you just drop this thing completely. He's like, you know, the people that are going to like this game will be able to pick it up because it's got such, you know, similar fundamentals as other games. You know, you move around, you don't get hit by things, and you throw your things at things, and they die, right? And, you know, his other point was that, you know, people that don't know these things, the no amount of tutorial is really going to make them good at this game because the game is all about, you know, being extremely dexterous with the gamepad and paying attention to all the little projectiles on the screen and that kind of stuff. And you know, it kind of made me realize that I was going down this path of extreme handholding when really it's better to just kind of put the player in the world, give them a nudge, and kick them out the door.
That's something that's interesting about the game design tactics, where you have these levels that are wonderfully designed and that kind of naturally guide the player. Is they're completely invisible to you when you're playing them. You know, you go back and play the original Mario Brothers, like I was saying, and it, because there's nothing overt, nothing in your face, you kind of miss that there's this invisible, brilliant game design. Super Metroid is another fantastic example of this really big, complicated world, and you have all these abilities and all these unlocks, and every step of the way, there's actually this article on Gamasutra. I think it's called The Invisible Hand of Super Metroid. But it kind of walks you through all this. Like, you come to an end where, oh, you're blocked and there's nothing you can do here, but they also, you know, plant a seed. They give you a clue in how you might later be able to solve this. Like, it's just out of your reach. You just need to be able to jump higher or something like that. And these days, with modern gaming kind of shoving tutorializing and how to do things and accessibility and helping you down your throat, it's in your face, and so it kind of affects you, you know, and it pushes you in a direction because it is very overt. And we started to notice that we were going down that path just because, you know, you're overwhelmed with so much work you have to do on this game. Anything that you can kind of use by example is a decent starting point, but in this case, it turned out to be detrimental.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, maybe that the idea of intuitive systems and Super Mario, right? Like, I don't know. Are we more trained to learn that stuff in platformers and Zelda-style top-down games and stuff we recognize? And is that why Spelunky can grab people and make them, you know, you say you don't want to learn when you're playing, but Spelunky, and maybe you haven't been playing Spelunky lately, but that game makes you learn a lot, but does it in a way that feels like Mario, feels very intuitive, feels like stuff you've grokked a million times before in games.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. I love learning about the world. I love learning about the environment. I love learning the delicacies around the subtle input gestures in Spelunky. You can run across like single width pits and stuff like that. I love learning that stuff, and it doesn't feel like learning, right? It feels like fun. And when I instead play a game where every single button does something complicated and there's, you know, this entity affects that entity and you have to go into the menu and select different items, that feels like learning. That feels like schoolwork. It's not fun.
Yeah, it's the difference between I was gonna say it's the difference between reading an interesting book on a complicated topic and getting homework, right? anyone yeah. Bueller yeah, kind of thing. What were you saying?
Exactly.
I would say, you know, it's also kind of like people that learn by doing versus people that learn by reading.
Sure.
You know, yeah. I've always kind of been, the only way that I'm interested in something or I'm going to learn anything or retain any knowledge is if I'm doing it. You know, if I'm reading a paper about something, I'm going to retain, you know, maybe 1% of what's come through my brain. And so I think that, you know, games like that, like Spelunky or you know, A Wizard's Lizard or Binding of Isaac, you know, the way that you learn about the world is by trial and error. And it works really well that way because you get to learn, one, by experience. You know, you like, oh, I shouldn't walk into that thing anymore. It hurts me. And like, when you learn things through experience, they tend to take hold a lot easier. And as opposed to, you know, something where you're like, oh, I have to remember that I need this stat because it affects this game system in such a way. And it may not be completely obvious to you how that, the relationship between like the stat and the world.
Yeah, yeah. What stats can hypothetically gain you is that when you're not playing the game, you're thinking, oh, if I only I did more of that. But no, even that's bullshit, because when you're playing a game that's really intuitive, you could think, oh, if I, you know, I should have missed the thing, I should have not hit the spike, I should have done X, Y, or Z, right? Because that's, I don't know, maybe that's what any game with depth is going for, is that it can occupy your head while you're not playing it. I can kind of, you know, colonize your imagination.
Right.
Which is kind of a powerful thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, game design is hard.
That's a good thesis statement. Yeah, I've seen very little evidence to the contrary.
Right. It's harder than it seems. It has that problem of, you know, from the outside it can look pretty simple, and it kind of speaks to that invisible hand aspect, right? Like, it looks easy because there was so much work put into it to make it feel easy, but when you actually get into the trenches and you try to build that yourself, you can then get a feeling for all these hidden elements and traps and secrets, like the stuff that you can't see from the outside.
Yeah, well, there's the, you know, you've studied audio engineering, right? So, like, there's that old edict in sound design where most people don't notice it until it fucks up. And that's, right. I think game design is usually pretty similar, right? Most people are aware of what really, really bad game design looks like, but they're not aware of the little things that make good game design pop necessarily, right? It's something you have to learn to see.
Right, yeah. Which makes it extra amazing, all these early game designers, you know, like the people who were involved with Super Metroid, they didn't have these examples to go by. They didn't have a whole lot of other games they could play to get that great feeling and then examine it and figure out what was going on. They invented that stuff, and it was brilliant.
Well, you know, what's that saying? You know, something about the necessity of invention.
Yeah, necessity is the mother.
Limitation.
Yeah, limitation. Yes. Limitation is the stepfather of innovation, or something.
Yes.
Yep. I'm gonna butcher that quote, but you know, you get the gist.
I've been thinking about for a while how good it would be to do a Twitter bot that just misquotes people. You know what I mean? Just gets it wrong enough. Yes.
Yeah. Horse quotes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Awesome.
Cool. Well, I'm sure you guys have other stuff to do, so I don't need to take up any more of your time if you need to go. But thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I hope it was as much fun for you as it was for me. It's always fun to talk to somebody who's making interesting stuff and also somebody who has also thrown themselves against the wonderful wall that is Spelunky.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and you know, we always like talking to kindred spirits. So.
Absolutely. So I'll be playing the game a lot more. So you know, maybe I'll shoot you an email and let you know how it goes. But in any case, I'm really enjoying it, and I will be sure to share with those, you know, everybody out there in podcast land that it is really good, and they too should check it out, especially if they're on a wavelength similar to the one we've been discussing with the PDL or whatever term we land on. So it's a great example of that. And worth everybody's time for sure.
Well, since you're on the podcast land thread, I'll go ahead and plug our podcast. It's called Lost Cast, and we publish it every Tuesday. And it just talks really about running an independent game company. It used to be more about HTML5, and then it was more about game design. And these days, it's about taking, you know, a game to market on Steam and that kind of stuff. Because it's really, we just talk about the things that we're dealing with at that point. In our game studio's lifetime.
Excellent. Well, everybody listen to Lost Cast. Everybody play a Lizard's Wizard. I said it. Damn it. I messed it up.
Everybody does.
While plugging it's
a tongue twister.
But while plugging it, I messed it up. That breaks some kind of terrible cardinal rule. It's a Wizard's Lizard, and you should play it. Okay. Thank you both a ton for being here, and have a
thanks
good one.
Thanks a lot, Drew. You too. Thanks.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Well, that is very much the show. Thanks just one more time to Jeff Blair and Matt Hackett for stopping by. You can find The Lost Cast and A Wizard's Lizard at lostdecadegames.com. You can also get the game on Steam or in the Humble Store, aka that place that gives you a DRM-free copy as well as a Steam key, but where you can't pay in trading cards. Additionally, you can subscribe to this podcast, the one you are currently listening to right now, on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbay, or any place else that the healing light of RSS can touch. Also, if you successfully create a beloved indie game in Flash 2, I will instantaneously burst forth from your computer like some sort of celebratory podcasting genie to congratulate you, interview you, and challenge you to a rousing game of Nidhogg. etao.wordpress.com